Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Thanks for joining us. Talk about the breakthrough story, really, of 2018. I'm the host of Climate One and delighted to be here with you today. Fires have always raged across California and the American West, but rising temperatures, growing population, suppression of natural fires, and building in forested areas has created a highly combustible situation, driving wildfires of historic proportions. So many wildfires have ravaged California the last few years, it's hard to keep track of the death toll and the damage to property. The recent Camp Fire is the most destructive in the state's history, having killed 88 people and destroyed nearly 14,000 structures. Fires are also hitting Oregon and Washington, where the costs of fighting fires are now at all-time highs. During our town hall here today at the Commonwealth Club, we'll hear stories from the front lines, lessons from recent fires, and the hard choices the communities will face to deal with the upset of the operating system that supports our lifestyles and our economy. We'll also discuss what wildfires mean for you, your personal health, your home nestled in a wooded area, and natural lands that you care about. Our distinguished guest, Keith Gillis, chair of the California Board of Forestry and Fire Protection, professor of forest economics at Berkeley. Tom Porter is chief of strategic planning at the California Department of Forestry and Fire, Cal Fire. And Curtis Alexander, you probably read a lot of his stories covering wildfires for the Chronicle. And Maggie Kelly, professor of environmental science policy at Berkeley. Please welcome me and give them a nice warm welcome. Tom Porter, first, let's just start by thanking you and all of your colleagues for serving. We saw a real upswell in this country after 9/11, but what he and the people at Cal Fire have done for us and other people, let's just acknowledge their service. Thank you. Truly, truly heroic and remarkable what you and your team have done. So take us, you live this, you're a professional fire person. Take us to the front lines and some of the moments, what it's like to be there through over time, some of these wildfires in California.
Yeah, you framed up very well what we saw in the Paradise Fire, which is the campfire. And so I'll come back to that, but I really wanted to kind of take the opportunity to kind of take you through a little time. Each one of us has come to a point, I'm sure, and what has changed? And at what point in our lives have we seen this change occur? We've been talking climate change for years. We've been watching ice flows and different things, and we're seeing different reports, and all of that is linked. And I'm going to take you through a little piece of time again. 1970, I was just a little kid. And I was growing up in the mountains of San Diego, and I remember vividly watching for 3, maybe 4 days, a plume of smoke move across the southern horizon. And it moved from due south of my home, way off toward the coast. And when I was of age and learned about what fires are and that I lived in fire country, found that that was the Laguna Fire, 1970 in San Diego, at the time and for many years after, the largest fire in California history. That fire kind of framed my upbringing as far as what fire was, knowing all that. Move forward, college, UC Berkeley. I was Keith's student, among a few others of us. The tunnel fire. Anyone there remember that? Okay. These two events, so that was 1991. There's 21 years. Those were career fires. Both of those were career fires for firefighters. One that you would see once, maybe twice in a career, if you were lucky. And you would be able to carry that through your career and be able to talk with all the firefighters that were coming up about your career fire and what it means and what you need to be ready for and train for. Okay. So, 91. Now it's 2003. I'm a professional forester and firefighter back in San Diego. And the Cedar Fire breaks. And I watch a fire burn not exactly where the Laguna Fire was, but over the same distance, about a 35-mile distance, in 16 hours, not in 3 days. At that point in time, I knew there was a change. So that's 2000. And we were in a very similar kind of weather pattern then. We're just coming off a drought. We had tree mortality in the Southern California mountains, much like the Southern Sierras have the last couple of years. And we had this fire that dwarfed the size of the Laguna Fire and did it in a shorter period of time. Fast forward, career fires now every 10 years. That's multiple in a career. And then you get into the late 2000s, and we have fires that are occurring in the 50 to 100,000 acre realm, which was kind of the benchmark place for a career fire, somewhere between 50 and 100,000 acres. Now we're having multiple 100,000 acre fires every year. And so there is a change, and the change is migrating. We saw it first in Southern California. We're seeing it migrate north. And it is very much related to what's happening with the climate. And so preparing for that is kind of where we find ourselves. We're behind the curve, but we have been seeing it. We have been watching. We are understanding that there are changes. And so what I'm afraid of where we are and what we saw with the campfire. At the campfire, we saw a fire again that broke in an area that was inaccessible, and by modeling and all of our planning, 12 hours would be a very short period of time to get where it got to in 2 hours. Mm-hmm. And we were thinking more of like it was a day or two. And not on that day. We knew we had problems on that day. But we had planned that community extensively for evacuations. We knew we had an evacuation problem. A new state highway was built to service that community, to get people in and out of there. We spent $7 million over the last several years on fuel reduction project work. It was a very fire-adapted culture in that community. And still, within 2 hours of the start of that fire, there were 100 spot fires starting in downtown Paradise between the people that were in the early stages, the staggered evacuation that we had planned for. Get these people out first, then those people, then the next people. They got stuck behind the fire that had already passed them because it was embers dropping out in front of their evacuation. And so our firefighters spent all of their time that first 12 plus hours getting people out of the way. Bulldozers were not cutting line. They were pushing cars off of roads to clear them so other cars could get out. Firefighters were dragging people out of their cars, herding people who were running into parking lots of box stores and other large parking lot areas where they could get people reasonably safe for a short period of time and defending the life. They weren't defending those structures. They were just keeping the people from being overtaken by the fire. Fire was burning around, then move the people off. And that is the environment we find ourselves in. And we are and will be continuing to work with technology to further our understanding. We are looking hard at better detection measures with cameras that are fixed, also aerial surveillance, and then persistent satellite imagery. So we can watch and understand what's going on more real time, but also detect those starts. Now, the one caution I have about that is if we put every fire out at a small size, we're going to be right where we got ourselves to 100 years from now. So we've been 100 years of heavy fire suppression, putting every single fire out as fast as we can. We have overgrown areas. So we need to balance that with fuel reduction. Some of that is going to have to be by manual means in some fashion, but we need to use more prescribed fire. And we need to work toward an acceptance of prescribed fire to manage the fuels so that we don't end up in this scenario again 50 to 100 years from now, should we be so lucky to have that opportunity.
Thank you. Keith Gillis, prescribed fire, planned fire, there's a trade-off there for a long-term benefit, but the reality is that it makes it smoky today. It creates and could violate federal law. So tell us about the tension of prescribed fire helping the forest for the future, but making a smoggier day today.
Well, one of the great victories of the environmental movement was the Clean Air Act, right? And PM 2.5, the small... less than 2.5 micron particulates are one of the things that come off fires, and they come off diesel engines, and they come out of a lot of other activities we do. And the Clean Air Act was written very specifically to protect the health of the most sensitive members of the population. And it is a very strongly written law because the social consequences of exceeding air quality for the people that are really sensitive are so high. It was even written not from a standpoint an economist like myself would write it, where you would say, well, we can tolerate worse air in a place with low population because a high population area will have more sensitive people. The standards were written in terms of the individuals that are sensitive in an area. So prescribed fire is going to, as a direct management action, always going to be competing with everything else we do that impairs air quality. And that's not to say we can't do more prescribed fire, and we should be doing more prescribed fire, because as a forester, when I can manage something by a natural process, I'll manage it with the natural process. But we can't simply believe that prescribed fire we'll do all the work. As Tom says, prescribed fire is part of the answer. It's a very cost-effective answer in many places. But we do have to think about the public health consequences. You're going to have subsidized activities where you remove vegetation. You're going to have vegetation removal in the form of harvesting forest products that can pay for itself. But in the end, I think what we've seen is you're either going to remove some of the vegetation that would occur in the absence of fire, or you're going to have fire, and that you can't have it both ways. You can't exclude fire from the landscape and restrict your vegetation management activities.
Maggie Kelly, what are some of the new technologies that you're working with that can give us visibility into the fire areas, the risks? You know, what can homeowners look to see how their relative risk? You know, maybe I've cleared my yard, but geez, my neighbor's got a lot of fuel load next door. What tools are emerging for this?
There are a lot of very exciting new technologies emerging in this arena. I'm a geographer by training, and I'm fascinated by maps. And maps and disasters are critical friends. So every successful disaster response really starts with a map. And we can think about mapping pre-fire and during fire and post-fire. And in all of those, there are some new technologies coming online that can be useful. We've heard a lot about the issues behind the new abnormal of fires, the buildup of fuels, the drying out of the vegetation. In 2018, there are going to be two new satellites launched that are going to look that are targeting those two things, measuring forest fuels, with a satellite-based air a laser device, which is very exciting, to really be able to measure forest fuel accurately, and then forest moisture. These are two sensors on that are going to be on board the International Space Station launched by NASA. One of them launches tomorrow, which is very exciting. It's called JEDI. So pre-fire, we've got some stuff coming up. Tom also mentioned being able to detect these early ignitions early enough to put them out is going to be critical. Also, just the better mapping of fire hazard across the landscape at fine scales, at household scales, and mapping fire risk. How is an individual house impacted, as we were just hearing from their neighbor, et cetera? All of these things are coming along. They exist. They're getting better. We've got to get them out to you guys and to the community faster. So in all of these, pre, during, and post-fire, I think communication and outreach is critical, and maps play a huge role there. During fire, we do amazing things. CAL FIRE does amazing things, building these fire perimeters so that we can help with evacuation and this harrowing story we just heard about. And post-fire, we have a lot of technology to look at the actual impact of these individual burns. We do these from satellite-based remote sensing. There's been a satellite or a series of satellites that the U.S. launched 40 years ago. It's called Landsat, and it's still up there, and it's still cranking, and it's still great. And it provides a global standardized look at the impact and the intensity of burns. So all of these things together form this very sophisticated mapping capacity that can be brought to bear for fires and other disturbances. But we've also got to think about ways to enable all of you. These guys are the front line of the fires, but you guys are the next front line. And so we've got to be able to find ways to get these technologies in your hands so that we can have people respond quicker when there is an emergency, such as something like these new normal fires.
One example of that, now there's air monitors, Purple Air, there's others where you can look at PM2.5 in your neighborhood. Used to be just there's one EPA central place, maybe it's a few miles from where you live. Now you can look at PM2.5 on your block. You can buy one yourself,
yeah,
so you
right.
know what the air you're breathing. Curtis Alexander, you've written about the fixes to this. Tell us about the other pieces of fixing this in the future, particularly the role of the state government and local government. There's a lot that's going to have to be some tussle there in terms of where the power lies to change things for the future.
Well, to echo what my colleagues here were saying, one of the things that I've learned from speaking with researchers and policymakers and forest managers is there's not one overarching solution to the wildfire problem. The Trump administration, as many of you probably heard, would like to have you think that it's an easy problem. It's all about forest management. There's others, environmental groups, who will point the finger at climate change and say, if we just make conditions less dry and less hot, wildfires will take care of themselves. I think the fix is probably going to be a combination of various strategies. That starts with, first of all, forest management, which we've talked a lot about here. And I think prescribed burning is one of the tools. Unfortunately, we haven't done a lot of prescribed burning. When you look at the acreage that's been burned in California, it's a relatively small amount. I was just looking at it the other day. Last year, between CAL FIRE and the Forest Service, they burned probably about 60,000 acres last year. The wildlands managed by CAL FIRE and the U.S. Forest Service is more like 50 million acres. So we talked about some of the problems that make it hard to do prescribed burning, but getting rid of those fuel loads that fuel these deadly fires is extremely important. Also, mechanical removal of trees is important. Putting forest breaks around communities is important. We also have talked a little bit about fireproofing homes and where homes ought to be developed in the first place. As Maggie pointed out, we have the maps and the technology to know where there's high-risk areas, yet often we continue to build in these areas. And even up in wine country, where the Tubbs Fire burned, you had seen fire burn there before. The Hanley fire in 1964 burned almost the same path as the Tubbs fire, and that area is well known for its winds out of the east and dry conditions in the fall, yet we're already seeing a lot of building taking place in and around Santa Rosa. And finally, there is, as we've talked about, a lot more we can do as far as responding to fire goes. The alert systems that we saw both in Paradise during the campfire and in Wine Country didn't really go out to everybody. People did not have fair warning. So there's a lot of improvement that can be made with our emergency alerts. Evacuations have been a problem as well. That can be improved. And I think finally we just have to keep in mind that about 95% of California's fires are started by humans. So kind of reaching out and getting people not to be a source of ignition, whether it's talking to PG&E about undergrounding their power lines or doing more education to make sure people who are towing boats don't have a chain dragging behind their truck and accidentally start a fire.
Keith Gillis, a lot of the country lives paying a lot of attention to hurricane warnings, weather warnings, that sort of thing. Fire risk warnings, we don't really pay attention to them. We're not sure what it means. What should we do? Are we going to entering a world where fire warnings need to be on the leading the news, on the front page of the newspaper, pay a lot more attention to them?
Well, yes. And the interesting thing is populations do learn from experience with natural hazards. But with the fires, we have almost too much information. And so I am worried that it sounds as though tornadoes happen in the summer, something like that. So we have to make sure that the messages have the right response. We're lucky in that we've seen enough evidence that people need to pay attention to the warnings. But I'm not sure that our messaging is right yet, that some of the messaging we've done was really developed as interagency communication. And so we need to work on how we communicate to the public. I do think the fire agencies have done, working with other emergency services people and the police, a better job of communicating actionable information to people in real time in the last couple of years. There's actually a change in the nature of the briefings of the information they're getting out. But we need people to respond in ways that will inconvenience them more, but we need to make sure the signals are right. And I think that's the balance the agencies are struggling with in terms of evacuation notices, is what's the right level of alarm to raise in what situation, and not actually have people become so accustomed to the message that they fail to take the actions you're trying to precipitate on their part.
Tom Porter, that was a problem in New Orleans before Katrina. People didn't evacuate. They said, we've heard this before. It won't be as bad as they're saying. People stayed.
Yeah, and that is something we worry about, and we've seen as backlash. Often when we have a big fire, the inconvenience leads to future lack of wanting to go through that inconvenience again. Some people leave their home, they're gone, they have to be gone for a week or longer, they come back and their home is fine. Their neighborhood is fine. And we are finding in some cases, people have decided, next time I'm not going. My dad, who lives in rural San Diego, same house that I watched that Laguna fire from, he is pretty sure that he doesn't want to be evacuated again. He's been evacuated in the last 10 years three different times and has been away from his house for a week or more at a time. And I keep telling him, go early. But he it's hard to convince my own dad of this. and I would think he'd be listening, but
if I could jump in on that, there's no one measure of destructiveness for a wildfire. There are really three that we tend to throw around. One is the size of the fire, but that's a distant third. Intermediate is structure loss, and that's terrible, but the first criteria is public safety. And if the public isn't getting information on which they act appropriately, we're not actually managing for the most important of these three criteria for destructiveness, which is public safety, that for us to live safely in a wonderful environment that is our ecology is driven by fire in this state. That's where we live. For us to live safely in that environment, we need, any time there's an evacuation notice, the public's response to generally just be, great, I'm out of here. And we need them to be prepared with go bags and so forth so that they can effectively leave. Because if we're looking at the loss of life, it's the evacuation phase. It's the early period when the fire service, the police are doing everything they can to manage public safety. And fighting the fire is sort of a very distant goal at that point. So, Tom?
I was thinking as we've been going through this discussion, if you could stretch time and say 12 hours from now, there is going to be an earthquake that is going to severely damage the peninsula. And I'm going to leave your minds to go wild with that. But if we could say it's going to happen in 12 hours, 98% chance, would you leave?
Yeah.
And I think where we are with, we're getting close with wildfire weather. And we're getting close. The utilities are freaked out. They're doing public safety power shutdowns throughout the state. And I'm not sure it's not with good reason. I know there's good intention there. There's also some other concerns about their own cost. I understand that. But it is public safety power shutdown. And people are up in arms in some areas about that. And again, it's an inconvenience thing. Your power might not be back on for a week. But if it stops that fire from starting upwind of your location, then maybe we got the warning 12 hours till that earthquake and it didn't happen because of some mitigation that occurred. So I think we need to look at all of these, and Curtis is absolutely right. This is a systematic, wide approach that we have to take. And I think it's Californians need to wake up and realize that every acre in California can and will burn someday.
Yes.
And Tom Porter, I just want to pick up on that 98%. What I hear you saying is what we just went through in this area with smoke coming into the Bay Area, these kinds of fires, it will happen again. It's not like Absolutely. A hurricane where like, well, that was a bad one. Another one will come in another 20 years. We're good for a while. Is that correct?
Yeah. And it's going to happen more frequently. There were times over the last 100, 200, 10,000 years where the Bay Area was inundated with smoke, and it's just happening more frequently. And there are more receptive people to be affected by that as well.
But it's your reference to things like hurricanes with climate change that make this a national topic about our entire societal response to natural hazards. Because in the case of hurricanes, their paths, the number and frequency of high-intensity hurricanes. The evidence is mounting from scientists that I know personally that we're going to see other natural hazards hitting us with greater frequency in the same way that we're experiencing fire.
Yeah. If you're just joining us, we're talking about the fires in Northern California with Tom Porter, Chief Strategic Planning at Cal Fire, Maggie Kelly, Professor at the University of California, Berkeley, Keith Gillis, Chair of the California Board of Forestry, and Curtis Alexander, Reporter for San Francisco Chronicle. I'm Greg Dalton. Maggie Kelly, fire, you know, has always been here in California, we've been hearing, but it came into the Bay Area in our lives, in our lungs, in a way that it really hadn't before this year for such a long period of time. Air quality like like Beijing, seeing respiratory masks on young people. Tell us about how that kind of punctured our consciousness and brought something that used to be over there into our lungs and our lives.
I think that's absolutely true. I'm a Berkeley native. I was born and raised here. I remember the tunnel fire, and that was sort of a one and done. Wasn't going to happen again. And we did a great job. We have the fire memorial out there by the tunnel. It was sort of like this was one event, and now we've moved on. But that smoke level over those 10 to 12 days, I think, really changed all of our minds about fire and just the horror that was coming through the media. We were hearing about what was happening in Paradise and then seeing what was happening down in Malibu. On the heels, really, of last year's Sonoma-Napa fire complex, it was eye-opening to everybody. It was in a very visceral way. As a mapper and a technologist, I also was just incredibly amazed at the way every single person I was talking to was just like you were talking about, Greg, was looking at purple air, was looking at the new the earth wind patterns, trying to anticipate when the winds were going to shift. Everybody was talking about this as a connected. We were connected to those people in Paradise. We were connected to everybody. I think it really grounded us in a way. I personally would love to see, I think California, we're at the cutting edge of climate change in terms of its impact, and I believe we're at the cutting edge of climate change in terms of adaptation, and I think we can make fire a huge part of that statewide portfolio. I'd like to see much more statewide money being put to all of the things we're talking about, but also the science communication. How do we do outreach? How do we have smarter fire-safe communities? How do we spread the message pre, during, and post-fires? And, of course, I think maps are part of all of that, but I really think that this has been a game-changer year, and we've got to make some changes.
Tom Porter, you're focused a lot on the fires ahead, but I'd like to quote something I saw on Nextdoor, which is this application for neighborhoods here in San Francisco, where people went on and they said, hey, I'd like to suggest that you don't burn wood in your fireplace this year, because one person said, where people are traumatized from fires and smoke, it'd be great if people didn't burn fires in their fireplaces these days. And there was a robust debate about it going gas, et cetera. You deal with the post-fire trauma all the time. Is that coming into consciousness in urban areas?
Yes. And that's something that we see pretty regularly. People who have had kind of a visceral response to something that's been scary or uncomfortable. And in this case, for a very long term, that smell of smoke does bring back all of those thoughts, memories, and concerns. I think, as I was stating earlier, I'm afraid if we go too far down that road, we need to remember that there's good smoke and bad smoke. And on a day like today, again, there's going to be good smoke and bad smoke, but generally, this is not a wildfire kind of day. We have a cool, more damp climate kind of condition that's going on, and we need to be able to utilize those kind of days for some of the fuel work that I was talking about. Now, burning fuel wood in your fireplace, that's something that brings back a very warm feeling to many of us as well. And I think it's an important piece of our psyche to be able to be close to and with fire. And I think we still need to have that opportunity. But again, for the broader public good, there are air quality issues that we need to watch for. And then we also need to look at managing our environment as well.
Curtis Alexander, you've written about how these fires are affecting California's greenhouse gas emissions. Tell us about the impact, all this carbon, biomass burned, what's been the carbon impact, and connect it to us, the climate equation for the state.
Yeah, well, not only is climate helping drive these fires and increasing the amount of area burned, but the fires are actually having an impact on the climate, or starting to anyway. In addition to the loss of lives and property we've seen from the fires, they're spewing out a lot of greenhouse gases. Last week, the State Air Resources Board estimated that the campfire put out about 3.5 metric tons of carbon dioxide and heat-trapping gas, which is about as much as all the cars and trucks in California put out in a week. One fire by itself is not going to sort of make or break the climate, but when you have a lot of these big fires like the campfire, you do see a problem as they contribute increasingly to global warming. Last year, the state estimated that all the big fires created or put out the equivalent of about 10% of total greenhouse gas emissions from human activity. And that's not the only problem. As you know, the forests are also, they help absorb carbon dioxide. The trees and the plants take it in when they grow. And when the forests burn, you lose that absorption. And scientists now are sort of debating whether or not the forests are giving off more greenhouse gases or whether they're taking in more greenhouse gases. And that's a problem as we're trying to take atmospheric carbon, try to lower the amount of atmospheric carbon, yet we have the forests beginning to give it off.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
Keith Gillis, one innovation that's coming forward is something called the Forest Resilience Bond, which is $4 million. Oh. There's a couple of foundations, an investment firm, and an insurance company trying to get people to make money by raking the forest or at least, you know, clearing up the forest. And so this is because, let's be clear, I mean, Cal Fire and the government's not going to have enough money to do all this. So is there a way for markets to come in and for there to be profit and kind of reducing fuel loads in forests?
I am an economist, so I am always thinking, how do you do this other than just on the general public ledger? So they just had the first forest bond close, I believe, last week. And the idea there is that there are parties like water districts that would benefit from the fact that there's a direct relationship between forest stocking and water yield from a watershed. Some of the earliest experiments in hydrology at Hubbard Brook showed that linkage very clearly. There's also the issue of a more resilient landscape with lower stocking could result in less sediment and debris moving into water impoundments, which is a major cost. You know, you try and manage the soils very carefully around water impoundments in order to maintain the capacity of the reservoirs underneath them. And so, yeah, there's some cases where if we can establish a credible link between the costs of, say, a water district or an insurance company and activities in the forest, that there's an additional source of fund in addition to the cap and trade funds or whatever that the state is using to do work like this. And that same principle extends to if we can have a viable source of wood coming especially off the public lands that could support a biomass energy. It could well be that people will make the $10 to $100 million investment in facilities that will utilize some of that material and make the drain on the public coffers to do vegetation management proximate to communities quite a bit reduced. So market solutions are always great.
Tom Porter, we've heard some things about the role of wind speed. Tell us how important that is and how the wind speeds we're seeing now in these fires are different or than what you've seen earlier.
Well, and that's a very good question. And what we're seeing is as wind speed increases, and it depends on the depth of the wind too, how far up in the atmosphere or close to the surface those sources of wind are. But in a lot of cases, we are seeing winds that are carrying high altitude speeds at a lower altitude, if that makes sense, and carrying embers and fire much further and faster than normal. And just in the case of the fire that the campfire that burned Paradise, Magalia, Concow, and other communities, there's a dogleg or a bend in the Feather River Canyon where this fire started. And typically the winds, even with a moderate kind of northeast wind, would funnel down the canyon. And that's not what happened in this case. The fire went straight up and over two ridges and ended up in Paradise in 2 hours. The fires that happened prior to this, and this is what I was talking about previously, with what we have modeled is not what's happening. We modeled what we expected to happen based on the past, and that's not what's been happening. So those fires usually would have done a turn a little bit to the south and gone more toward Oroville, Lake Oroville, and then would have come up into the community from a different place. That's not what happened. So the wind speed is wind speed, the frequency of these phone winds, east winds that are coming off of the dry land mass, that is making a difference as well.
Yeah, more hot air circulating in the system, another sort of little climate element there. Curtis Alexander, what happens after the fires are out? People tend to rebuild. It's still just over a little year, over a year from the North Bay fires, Wine Country. A lot of people are still arguing with their insurance company, trying to rebuild. So tell us about, you know, a year after, when the news reporters are gone, or maybe you go back after the anniversary, what it looks like for a community to rebuild out of something like all these fires.
Well, it takes a lot of time, as you pointed out. In Sonoma and Napa counties, they're just beginning to rebuild now. Up at the campfire, people haven't even been allowed back to their homes yet, so we don't know what's going to happen there. The process begins, it actually began this week when the EPA went in to remove hazardous debris from the communities. After that, we expect to see about a 6 month or longer period when you'll have the Army Corps of Engineers and CalRecycle, a state agency, come in and begin moving a lot of the debris, the homes, the bricks, the cars, everything else out of the way. And then from there, it's pretty much between the property owners and their insurance companies about what they're going to do next. And as we saw in Wine Country, a lot of people didn't have as much insurance as they had hoped and have had to downsize their plans for rebuilding or even move out of the area. And up at the campfire in Butte County, it's even a lower income area. So we kind of expect to see more of that up there.
Yeah, one tip I've read is call your insurance company and ask what would it cost to rebuild. You could be underinsured and not know it until it's too late. Tom Porter, during the drought, we saw the government get involved in kind of lawn level. You can wash your car this day, not that day. You can do this, not that for your lawn. Are we going to get there in terms of regulation at the property level for what people can do with their vegetation, that sort of thing? Is that coming?
Well, we'll see. 2017 was a very active fire-related legislative year, and I would expect that 18 is probably going to add to that. One of the things that came out of 17 was more of a landscape-level forest management type of mantra. Particularly with Senate Bill 901, but many other Senate and Assembly bills. And then there were several that had us re-looking at our prescribed fire programs and increasing the use of prescribed fire and fuels reduction. Now, that is not on an individual, like, house-by-house kind of basis.
Right.
There are some existing laws, and we will be looking at retrofitting, hardening buildings, land use planning. All of those items are on the table. We also have pretty good laws in place and regulations in place for new communities. It's now, what are we going to do with retrofitting existing and rebuilding communities?
Can you envision that there'll be certain parts of the state where a politician or people have enough courage to say, we're not going to build there, we shouldn't build there, or if we do, you know, it's at your own peril?
That is yet to be seen.
We're going to include you in this town hall conversation. We have a microphone in the back. We have about 22 minutes left. Since this is a town hall format, we'll give you a little space to make a comment, share your thoughts, experiences, just to briefly identify yourself, and we'll get through as many as we can. Welcome. Yes.
Yeah, good afternoon. Thanks so much for hosting the conversation and panelists for your expertise. My name is Sandra Lupien. Just for a little bit of context, I'm a longtime environmental policy and communication strategist. So my question is, you know, consensus has grown significantly over the past several years that, in fact, as you've been discussing, forest management in a sustainable and ecological way is absolutely necessary, including some thinning and controlled burning. But we're already seeing a threat to that consensus based on the Trump effect, right? Trump coming out here and saying, you know, well, what we need to do is rake the forests. And, you know, we're already seeing this polarization starting to happen again. And I think in order for people who really care about smart forest management in California to be effective, we have to take back that message. And part of that is really educating urban environmentalists, people like me, probably a lot of you in this room, about the necessity and the ecological necessity of forest management. So I guess what I'm really wanting to ask is, you know, I think a lot of that has to do with being able to provide assurances that forest management is not akin to commercial logging and is not akin to clear cutting. What assurances can you offer?
We'd like to tackle that. Tom, I think that might, Tom or Keith?
One way you could get some assurances is look at the way the state regulates private lands. We don't have a lot of leverage on public land management from a state perspective. It's really actually to different environmental standards, CEQA versus NEPA. All of the mechanisms that the Board of Forestry has put into the Public Regulatory Code in recent years to encourage more active management of private lands, especially smaller private lands that are non-industrial, really are promoting very ecologically sound, sort of light touch, what we would call selection or uneven-aged forestry. And so all of the carrots we're trying to get people to manage their lands in a way that is both ecologically good for the multiple objectives we own land for, water, wildlife, visuals, aesthetics, recreation, and resilience, we can move a long way there by just enabling people to manage land rather than simply hold it in a custodial state. Some people will choose to do that regardless, but the state's working very active to create a regulatory environment in which light-touch sustainable forestry is not cost prohibitive for an owner to engage in.
I just want to add really quickly to that. I love this question about messaging and communication, and I think you're absolutely right, and I think we've got to take it back and say this sort of stuff that Keith is talking about is a win-win. It's a win for the forests. It's a win for water. It's a win for fire. It's a win-win situation, and we have to reframe that narrative.
Welcome.
Hi, Marcy Ronka. What month or season concerns you a bit that's coming up? And also, what exactly does this PM 2.5 do to your lungs? Mm. I mean, my husband had an inflammation that the doctor said could last 6 months, mm-hmm. 6 weeks, I mean. Mm. What is this stuff? Mm-hmm.
Can I take the fear factor question for me? Every month. There isn't a single month left in the calendar that doesn't scare me. When we get rain and persistent rain over several weeks, I feel better for a period. But that only lasts for a few months. And just the most persistent brush or chaparral species we have across California is chamise. It is a chaparral species. But chamise is across the entire state here and there. And chamise only drinks between about April and June. And so April to June, I'm usually feeling pretty good if it's been raining. But outside of that period of time, the fuel moisture in that plant alone is almost critical for the rest of the year. You can get it to burn.
Right.
Even if it's been raining.
Tom's agency, and in fact, yeah, to some extent, the Forest Service, although it has a national mission, mm-hmm, have had to fundamentally change their entire annual staffing patterns. Yeah. Because the threat doesn't have narrow confines on the calendar anymore. With respect to the public health dimensions, there was just a World Health Organization report out in the last week, which estimated what it can do to life expectancy at different levels of chronic pollution. And in India, that effect on life expectancy is quite large. In China, it is not quite as large. In the Bay Area, it would be very small at the moment. But the public health officials also, I think, are pursuing research that we need in the for the scientific basis for forest management in terms of what is the trade-off between acute exposure to small particles and chronic exposure to small particles. And that will play into this whole debate about the extent to which we can utilize prescribed fire in the state.
One footnote there, unrelated to fire, but the Air Board in this area has a plan to go diesel-free by 33. Diesel's a big source of PM2.5. Mm-hmm. They're going to try to get rid of all diesel, which would address the chronic yeah. exposure versus the acute exposure from wildfire. Welcome.
Thank you. My name is Amy Bach, and I run a charity called United Policyholders. My question is going to relate to the economic impact of climate change in the context of wildfires and what we can do to empower individual property owners to make it less likely that their property will burn and also that they will be able to continue to afford insurance. The governor had created a tree mortality task force a couple years ago. I got involved with the insurance subgroup because the insurance industry had noticed that we had a real problem here, and they've been gradually pulling out of some of the brush areas. So we spent a lot of time trying to figure out, in the context of mitigation, what can help save a house. And we really didn't get that far because we still have, okay, we know there's defensible space. Insurance companies are still very reluctant to incentivize, reward, give discounts, and we are working hard to do that. My organization helps consumers of insurance make good decisions. What can we be telling people, you know, besides put a screen on your attic vent to keep embers from coming back in, keep a perimeter of defensible space around your house, replace shake roofs? What else can people be doing? Because I know it's putting a big strain on firefighting resources also in these communities when people say, my insurance company's dropping me. Can you come out and tell them, give me a letter that says that I'm a good risk and that kind of thing?
Thank you. Good question.
It's a brilliant question, and I think Tom should answer part of this because his agency actually enforces yeah. some of the public regulatory code that deals with this. But the reason why I like your question is it is both what should I do physically and what should we do institutionally, because it's about institutional change as well as physical actions. So there are the mechanisms you can do. But as pointed out in the California Department of Insurance report that came out just about a year ago, there is not a particularly strong feedback loop between the actions that homeowners or communities might take and the rates that are charged on insurance. So if you're looking for a widespread mechanism to motivate people to do change, you're right. The insurance sector is one of the places to do it, but it has multiple levels. There's the safety of the home, but there's the safety of the block and the safety of the community.
Tom and Ford. That's the best broad answer. I think I was grateful to hear that you were a part of the Tree Mortality Task Force. Tree Mortality Task Force has morphed, and it's now a piece of the Forest Management Task Force, which is looking at more of a broad statewide perspective on all of this. Insurance and retrofitting and hardening of structures is part of that, and I would encourage you to come back. We're still meeting. If you look up the Forest Management Task Force, Governor's Forest Management Task Force, we still meet monthly, and we're working on some of those same issues on a more global California-wide setting.
But aren't those three that she mentioned the top three, vents,
yes.
defensible space, and roofs?
Roofs, and then single pane window replacement is a huge one as well. Yes.
Ah, that's a new one. Welcome.
Hi, my name is Maren Chesney, and my question was around goals. Clearly, like preserving human life is one of the goals. Clearly, eliminating all fires is not one of the goals. I was wondering if there's any sense or consensus around what the goals should be around fires in California.
Who'd like to tackle that? I had preparing for this, I went to the Smokey the Bear website, which I hadn't been to in a while, and there's quite a lot there about prescribed burn. He's not against all fires. Who'd like to?
Yeah. True. I think in general, Cal Fire can get behind FireWise communities, and really the idea that we need a resilient California, a place where fire can burn through and around communities and hopefully not destroy any structures, not destroy any infrastructure, not hurt or kill any people. But fire is part of the environment of California, and it's not going to go away. So we need to adapt to the fire as opposed to fire adapting to the people.
I was just going to throw one thing out there. As far as managing fires go, there were a couple big fires in the Sierra this summer that sort of illustrate the different approaches to handling fire. There was the Ferguson fire, which closed down Yosemite for 3 weeks this year, but a fire that didn't get a lot of attention nearby in the Stanislaus Forest was the Lyons fire. Because the Ferguson fire affected the park and there were homes in Mariposa that were affected, the Forest Service and Cal Fire made it a priority to put out that fire. But because the Lyons fire was burning up in the mountains, they actually let that fire burn for a number of weeks and try to do some of the things we've been talking about today, burn off the vegetation so that if fire does come back to that area, it's not going to be as intense a burn.
Welcome.
Hi, I'm Danielle Shreshi, and I have two questions. One is, has there been discussions or investments around moving utilities underground? And the second one is about how we care for our pets. You know, I have an N95 mask, but of course you see people all over the city with their animals outside, and if there's anything that we can do to protect them as well when there's hazardous air or unhealthy air.
Curtis, you've covered the utility undergrounding. Very expensive.
Yeah, it's very expensive. I spoke with some officials at PG&E about what they were doing, and one of the subjects that did come up was undergrounding their lines. They estimated that it costs about $3 million a mile to take the overhead lines and put them underground. The utility literally has tens of thousands of miles of lines, approaching 100,000. I haven't done the math, but I know that they don't have the money to do all that undergrounding right now.
And pets.
All I can say is that I'd like to give a shout out to the dean of the School of Veterinary Medicine at UC Davis and all of the people that have actually come up, I think, with some very timely and appropriate kind of interventions so that people have information as to how to evacuate with their pets. And that there is a support network later for both people's animals and pets. And, you know, that's a source of stress that we can actually deal with. And it's wonderful to see some organizations stepping in so that that's one less thing for a traumatized family that's been evacuated and maybe burned out having to deal with.
Yeah. Pets can be a source of comfort during that time. Like, welcome.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for all your insights. My name is Duncan Chung. I'm an educator, and I founded a nonprofit called Off Trail on Track to bring people out to appreciate nature and learn backpacking. One of the struggles I have is around cause fatigue. So today it's about fire. Yesterday is about gun control. The day before is about sexual harassment. There's so many issues that bombard consumers, citizens every day. I wonder what message would be salient around fire and around forest protection that we can that would be effective and because the issue is so complex, the solutions are multi-pronged. It's often hard to communicate that and let it stick. So I wonder what advice you would give to me and to everyone here, what kind of message that we can help spread and then continue to build breadcrumbs so that this isn't a 1-hour event. This isn't a year-long event.
Thank you. Who'd like to tackle that?
That's a very good, I will to start with. A very good question, and I'm going to bring it back to something that all of us can work toward. And then in your environmental curriculum, I think you have an opportunity to kind of morph this to how it works when out in the woods or back at home. And we have a program that's Ready, Set, Go, and easily that pertains to you can put yourself at home and say, okay, I need to be ready. I need to prepare for what could happen, whether it's earthquake, fire, hurricane, whatever it happens to be. You can prepare ahead of time. Understand what it is you need to do and get your buildings hardened. Your leaves raked, your defensible space, all of those things. And then set. Know when you have the potential for these things to happen. Watch the weather. Understand what the weather means on the big picture. Understand, I mean, if you're backpacking, you need to know what the weather is going to be. If you're going to be in inclement conditions, you may change your plans or you may just be prepared. That's the same thing. Be set. And then when it's time to go, you need to go. And that may be an evacuation order. That may be your nose in the air and seeing where that smoke is coming from that you're smelling when you're on a backpacking trip or whatever it happens to be. If the smoke is coming to you, the fire is coming to you. You need to know that. And so those are all just kind of some basic things, but the Ready, Set, Go program is really geared toward the home, but you can morph that to any disaster and build off of that. Sorry.
Curtis?
If I could just add one thing, it's a good question. How do we keep from not taking these issues for granted? Because we have seen it, like you mentioned, with mass shootings. We've seen it with political scandal. And that's a question we talk about in the newsroom is we keep covering the stuff, we keep putting the photos and the video and the stories out there, and will people become sort of cold to it? And I don't have a great answer to that, but I think hearing how it affects people you know, hearing how it affects people you can relate to, and hearing how it affects you if it's the smoke in the Bay Area, that's going to keep people tuned in, I hope.
I would like to just point out, it feeds into the prior question as to what are our objectives. And I think the issue of fire is a natural ecological driver here. We have to adapt to it. It's going to be with us. We have no intention of leaving California. The people in this room basically are Californians and happy to be there. But if you look at the coverage of the major earthquake that just happened in Alaska, and you think, what was the damage in terms of collapsed buildings or roads or fatalities? An earthquake of that magnitude that happened before Alaska implemented appropriate building codes and planning for natural hazards, one which they know, like San Francisco, they're going to be exposed to, it worked. It took decades, but with decades of work on managing their exposure to that natural hazard, what could have been really a terrible tragedy became a manageable amount of property damage.
Next question. Welcome.
My name is Jim Casper, a resident in Southern Marin. About 14 years ago, there was a 12-acre fire in Parkland, a quarter mile from my house. Got interested in activities as a result. My question is sort of looking for a comment back on a point and then a question. My comment is that it appears with the recent fires, more has been done at the property, the structure level, rather than vegetation. If you look at pictures even from the campfire, you'll see standing trees that are still green with property completely burned. Any comments about that? But more importantly, my question has to do with enforcement and regulations. My sense is with the local fire agencies that they either don't have the manpower, the skills, or the resources to enforce code that currently exists, much less any new code, and wondering what comments you have about being able to help them do that enforcement.
Tom Porter.
And this may have a Board of Forestry component to it. So, but I will take on the first part of that. On prevention is one of those things. It's prevention. You know, it's worth a pound of cure. However, it's hard to expend the funds on prevention when you don't know if it actually did something. So that is kind of where the quandary we've been in. We probably don't have enough inspectors. We don't have enough funded inspectors to do all of the inspection that we would like to do. What we have statewide, we have a hit every property every third year standard that we're trying to meet. We're not trying to touch everybody's property every year and do an inspection. And then enforcement comes on the back of that. So we do have the mechanisms to enforce, but our standard right now is to hit every third year. And so we have the inspectors to do that. We have just recently funded the inspectors statewide, and that includes the contract counties, of which Marin is not where Cal Fire, this patch, is, but we have a contractual arrangement with the county to provide the same level of service. They also get funding for the same things that we're expecting the rest of the state to do. And so that is on the defensible space side of things, where we are, and we will continue to improve that. As far as the trees that are still standing in Paradise, I think a lot of them, you just haven't seen them die yet. And trees will stand for a long time after fire comes through. Some of them will survive. Some of the buildings survived, and we will never know why some of those things happen.
Briefly, last question. Yes.
Yes. Two things that struck me about the Paradise Fire. One is that seniors, for the most part, were not considered in the evacuation process, especially those who needed help moving from their residence where they were living. And the second thing is that that schools were not in session, at least I think for the most part. And in our communities, parents are not going to be at home with their kids during the day. So we have no evacuation plans, no sites, assuming we don't. So my question to you is this a time when we need something new? Because we need something faster. And is it a time to create an emergency wildfire task force, private public, to look at what things do we need to design in terms of communication? Because if PG&E cuts the power for very long, how are we going to communicate? So, those solutions really, frankly, don't cut it as I see it. We have to look at what we need to develop to help, like for communications, for evacuations. We have signs posted, this is an evacuation route. Is it time for that, for fires? So that is my question to you. Would you consider the implementation of an emergency? Because it's timing. It's all about timing. We don't have 20 years to evacuate students from a high school, 2,000 students from a high school and figure out how to do it and where they should go, right?
Thank you.
So that's my question.
And that is a very important question, and one that we are talking about. And, of course, we're in an administration change with the governor's office, and so there are some discussions that are ongoing that will carry from the Brown administration into the Newsom administration. There's also Newsom ideas that are going to be brought in. And Gavin Newsom is very interested in the public-private, technology-based, science-based approach to fixing these problems. And I believe that we're going to be working very hard on that in the coming months.
We have to, good ending note. So that ends our town hall. I'm just curious, one last note. How many people here are on Twitter? Fair amount. I had a moment where I had a teenage son who was at a house in West Marin, didn't have a car, he doesn't drive like teenagers, and there was a fire, possible evacuation 2 miles away. And I got some pretty good alerts from Marin, but Twitter was the best source of information, and CHP was posting there, Marin Fire was posting there. So if you're not on Twitter, there's a good reason to get on Twitter. It's a best, with all due respect to the formal notification systems.
It's part of the portfolio now.
Yeah, it is. Right? Twitter is a great way to – it's a new use of Twitter you may not have thought of before. So all right, let's give a round of thanks to Curtis Alexander, Keith Gillis, Tom Porter, and Maggie Kelly. Thanks for joining us for this town hall. We'll hope to see you again soon. Thanks, everyone.